We get the law from 5 sources in this country. We're going to talk about a few of them in just a minute here. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. All laws have to agree with the Constitution. If a court decides that a law conflicts with the Constitution, it is called unconstitutional or invalid, and it is overturned. It is the Supreme Court's job, as well as all other courts in the country, to make sure that laws comply with the Constitution and with the interpretations of the Supreme Court to the Constitution. States can have constitutions as well. California has one. All of the states have them. But the federal Constitution is the supreme law of the land. But we get law from a whole lot of other places, too. Common law is made by judges. It's interpretations of laws. It is interpretations of precedents. It is interpretations of federal law. A lot of law is made by judges and juries. Okay? When we get to Chapter 8, we're going to be talking about shield laws. Shield laws are actually statutory laws, which we'll talk about in a minute. But in states that don't have shield laws, and there are about 15 to 20 of them, those states have to rely on judges' interpretations of whether or not there should be a reporter's privilege. Okay? So common law, of which there's a lot, also governs us. Statutes are written by legislatures at all levels. They get called statutes, they get called laws, they get called ordinances. Okay? All of those are created by organizations, legal organizations, at different levels of government. So city councils can make statutes, although they usually call them ordinances. State, federal, county, all of those bodies can make statutory law. There's also a bunch of law coming out of the administrative agencies. In the executive branch of the federal government, there are a lot of agencies that are under the president's jurisdiction, or the jurisdiction of the executive branch. Among those, the ones we're going to be talking about are the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the FBI, the CIA, and all of those organizations can make laws. For example, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, makes laws that govern broadcast television, and also is attempting to make laws governing the internet. And all of that comes down as administrative law. And finally, the last area of law I want to talk about is something called equity law. Equity law is a carryover from the English or British tradition. Normally, when you lose or win a civil case, money is involved. If you lose, you pay it to the winner. If you win, you get it from the loser. But when money doesn't help, money doesn't resolve the matter, equity law may step in. Let me give you an example. Let's say that I meet up with a student, and I really like the student. I think the student is a nice guy. We'll call him Jim. I say, you know, Jim, you're a really nice guy. Do you want to have coffee after class? Jim says, sure. So we go and have a cup of coffee. All right? I really like Jim. In fact, I'm going to use my administrative powers to find out what Jim's phone number is, and I'm going to start calling him. And then I'm going to find out where he lives and start driving by his house. Maybe I park outside to see if he's got a girlfriend. Now, if you're not getting creeped out by now, you should be, okay? What am I doing to this guy? I'm stalking him. What does he have to do to make me stop? Something called a restraining order. You're right, okay? A restraining order is something called an injunction. An injunction is an order to stop doing something. If I am enjoined, that's the verb, from doing something, that means I can no longer do it. Now, the court could fine me, you know, $1 million and tell me that I have to stop following Jim, okay? If the court fines me $1 million, I can still pay $1 million and keep following him unless there is an injunction in place. So an injunction serves to remedy a problem when money will not. Okay? It's probably the toughest area of law. Most of us understand what statutes are and maybe administrative laws, and many of us have probably heard about constitutional law. Equity law is somewhat different than all of that. And again, I know I can't ask you if you have questions, but if you do, of course, fire me an email. Okay. Now, there are also 2 areas of law to consider. When those of us who are old enough to remember the O.J. Simpson trial watched it, we were very happy, those of us who teach constitutional law or media law, because it taught people the difference between a civil trial and a criminal trial. All right, in a criminal trial, somebody has committed a crime, like rape or murder or theft or battery or assault. And usually it is the people of the state of California or the people of the county who bring charges against the alleged perpetrator. And what ends up happening? You sit in jail. Okay? In order to keep somebody in jail, The state has the burden of proof, and the state has to prove that the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That means 90% sure that it happened that way. You're 90% sure the person did the crime. Okay? In civil cases, however, civil law, it's really a controversy between two parties. Somebody is suing someone else for money. It's a property dispute, or a contract dispute, or a financial dispute. And there's no law being broken in the traditional sense of throwing somebody in jail. Right? Usually the plaintiff has the burden of proof, and the burden of proof is lower. It's a preponderance of the evidence. 50% are more likely that it happened that way, or more likely than not. Now, if you see the difference, of course, between 90 and 50%, that's a big difference. The state wants to be very sure that it is correct before it throws you in jail. Okay? When it's just money changing hands, the burden of proof can be lower. We'll talk a little bit more about the burden of proof in a little bit. Okay, I want you to set your pencils down and kick back with me. I'm going to tell you a little story. Rather than just spitting out definitions at you, I always kind of frame it in a story, and it's kind of a funny story. Although, at the time, I wasn't laughing so much. Back up to about 1999, I was just in the middle of getting my PhD, and I had gone to teach at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, which is in southern Indiana, not too far from Louisville, Kentucky. I had just gotten married. I got married in 97, so I'd been married about a year and a half. But my husband decided he was going to stay in Minnesota, and I was going to take the cat, which is not the same cat. We had a little tiny black cat named Collie. We used to call her the devil spawn. She was just a psycho little thing, 6 pounds of fury and claws and teeth. But I decided to take the cat with me and live in Bloomington. And my husband was living in Minnesota, and we did the commuter thing for a year. Worked out pretty well, although, you get lonely. Now, it was homecoming. And homecoming in Big Ten schools is a big deal. People drink a lot, they go out, there's usually windows broken, disorderly conduct, that kind of thing. And it was in early October. In fact, it was the day after my birthday. All right. So I had gone to bed, because I was an old fuddy-duddy professor, and I had gone to bed. I'd watched X-Files, David Duchovny, oh yeah, watched X-Files. Gone to bed, it was about 1:30 in the morning, and I had a two-bedroom apartment. I had my bed in one room. And in the other room, I had my office set up with the desk and the computer and, a spare bed for when my sister visited and all that stuff. And that had sliding glass doors that had vertical blinds on it. And my bedroom just had a small window facing out to a street. And I had just gone to bed and I heard kind of a sound. And the cat jumped off the bed and went into the other room. And how you wake up and you're like, yeah, did I hear that? Did I not? Fall back asleep. And probably 3 minutes later, I definitely hear a sound. And the cat is running back and forth in the little hallway between the two rooms. She's totally freaked out. So I get up, I'm wearing a long flannel nightgown, and I get up and I go in the other room and I see the silhouette of this guy standing outside, and he's clearly got his hands on the sliding glass doors and he's trying to break into the apartment. And I'm like, holy buckets, what am I going to do? And the cat is looking at me going, call the cops right now. Do not pass go, do not collect $200, call the cops right now. And so I figure, okay, he doesn't know that I'm home. If I turn the light on, he'll go away. Flip the light on. He pauses, but I can still see the outline. And by this time, he's gotten that glass door off. The cat is saying, call now. All right, I say. So I go and I pick the phone up. I have the phone in one hand, and I go and pick up a big, heavy law book. Because, I can assault him with that if I have to. And I pull open the vertical blinds, holding the phone kind of cradled in my arm with the book. And I see this guy standing out there, and he's clearly trying to break in the apartment, and he's wearing absolutely nothing. Stark naked. And I'm like, oh! And then I look at him, and I'm motioning to the phone, and I'm saying, get out of here. This is not your apartment. Go home. He looks at me, and he has proceeded at this point to drop the sliding glass door that he had pried out of the frame on his foot, which is broken and bleeding on my patio. Yucky. And so I'm saying to him, I'm pointing to the phone saying, 911, I'm going to call 911. Because clearly I knew he didn't have any weapons, but I'm bah, okay? So I finally decide, the cat is like, do it now. So I call the cops, and the cops say, well, it's homecoming, are you, I'm like, get over here, there's a naked guy trying to break in my house. Okay. The naked guy wanders off for a while, and the cop cars finally show up, and they apprehend him, and he is sort of wandering randomly around. They find his clothes scattered all over the yard. He's drunk off his butt. They put him in the cop car, he throws up in the cop car, and they take him down to the station and throw him in the drunk tank overnight. I'm scared to death. I'm trying to call home, and my husband threw the phone off. Big mess. Okay? Now, he gets charged with public drunkenness, public intoxication, public nudity, and attempted breaking and entering, because he never actually did get in. Okay? Now, pick up your pencils. The plaintiff in this case is the state of Indiana, okay, or the person who's complaining. I don't have to bring suit because it's a crime. So the state of Indiana, or the people, versus the defendant, who is naked drunk guy. Okay, he's found out later on he was a 23-year-old physics major. Okay, living upstairs from me, although he didn't live upstairs from me for very long. The apartment complex kicked him out. He was charged with, again, public intoxication, public nudity, and attempted breaking and entering. Now, when they called me to find out all my information, I told him, I'm a teacher, this kid's a student, I kind of understand it, I don't want him to be a sex offender, because of course in all states they have sex offender laws. I said, I don't want him to be a registered sex offender, just dry him out, have him do some community service and call it good. Well, I was pretty sympathetic as somebody whose house was, they tried to break in, so they decided to subpoena me to testify on the drunk guy's behalf. A subpoena is an order to appear. I'll say that again. A subpoena is an order to appear. And in this case, I was ordered to appear to give a deposition. A deposition is my statement of what happened. So the story I just told you, I would swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God, in front of his attorney and the state. Okay? A deposition is part of a process called discovery. In discovery, all sides put all their evidence on the table. Okay, so I tell my story, he tells his story. If there's any other evidence, get it on the table. You guys have all seen old movies where somebody comes running in, I have new evidence, I have new evidence. It doesn't work that way, exactly. Law and Order gets it pretty right, okay? Special Victims Unit is awesome. They get it pretty right. But part of discovery is getting all the cards on the table, in a sense. So really, you can't have too many surprises. Okay? Now, if I had disobeyed the order to appear and give my testimony, give my deposition, I could have been held in contempt. Contempt is a judge's way to punish me for disobeying an order of the court. So the order had to come from the court, and if I disobey it, I could be charged with contempt. We'll talk about more about that in Chapter 8. I could have sat in jail, or I could have been fined, or both. Okay? So, students always wonder, what happened to all of this? All right? It never did go to trial. The guy ended up settling. He pled out. Okay, he did a plea bargain to, I think, disorderly conduct. He never did have to be a sex offender, but the apartment complex kicked him out. And I don't know how long his record stands, but, all's well that ends well. If, however, it had gone to trial, of course, there would have been a jury. And to put a jury in place, you have to do something called voir dire, or jury selection. Voir dire is French for to see, to speak. Okay, and that is when, the judge swears you in, and the attorneys ask you questions to see if you're a good fit for them. Okay? One of the things you can honestly say after this class, when you are called before a jury, is that you have had some training in First Amendment law and in civil and criminal procedure. Not going to make any promises, but sometimes juries don't want, or defense or prosecuting attorneys don't want anybody on juries who knows anything at all about the law. Take that as you will. Okay. Now, precedent. Let me talk a little bit about precedent. Precedent is the idea that what comes before determines what comes now. Okay? Let me give you an example. If you drove somewhere, maybe you drove to work or to the grocery store or to class today, all right, you probably stopped at all the stop signs. If you didn't stop at a stop sign, you might have gotten through without getting pulled over. Okay? But let's say you ran, in the Midwest we used to call it California stops, you kind of roll through, alright? Let's say that you get busted for that and a cop pulls you over and you have been caught running a stop sign or running a red light. What's going to happen to you? You're probably going to get a ticket, right? Maybe you'll get a warning if you're lucky. Are you going to get shot? No, you're not going to get shot. That would be cruel and unusual punishment, which is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. But you also know, because friends and relatives of yours who have gotten stopped for running red lights or stop signs have gotten a ticket or gotten a warning. That's precedent. The idea that what has happened before determines what is going to happen now. The Latin is called stare decisis, or let the law stand, let the precedent stand. Okay? Precedent is very important, because it helps us build a body of law so that we know how to behave and we know what penalties will happen to us if we don't. Okay. Now, when the Supreme Court, or any court, writes a decision, you have what's called a majority opinion. A majority opinion is just that, one with which the majority of the justices agree. There are 9 justices on the Supreme Court, As you might guess, five of them make up a majority. So you've got to get five votes to have the law have any precedential value. Okay? Now, if judges agree, they can concur, which is the next one down there. They can write an opinion that says they concur, or they can just join the opinion. If judges disagree, they can dissent, which is disagree. Okay, and they can write an opinion that way. Most of the time we'll be focused on majority opinions because those carry the precedent. Those are the ones that really matter. We will occasionally talk about concurrences and dissents because they're important elements of the law. But most of the time it's going to be majority opinions. Now don't confuse this with the rule of four that we talked about. Four justices have to agree to hear the case, but in order for a majority to, you know, come to a conclusion, you got to have five. Okay. Now, sometimes at the appellate level, the court will interpret the law, and then they will remand or reverse and remand the case to the lower court. Again, appellate courts don't care about facts, so they may have to have the jury reconsider the facts based on the new area of law. They need to be re-instructed. So a reverse and remand or a remand is go back and do it right this time. Okay? We will often see remand in the literature or reverse and remand. Okay, we talked a little bit about injunction, in order to stop doing something, to stop stalking or to stop doing something else. The verb is to enjoin. A jury question we've also talked about a little bit. A jury question is a question of fact that has to be decided by the jury. So in a murder trial, the defense says X, the prosecution says Y, and it is up to the jury to decide whose set of facts is the truth. Now, the last couple areas here are mootness and ripeness and unconstitutionality. If a question is moot, M-O-O-T, that means it no longer matters. Okay? For example, let's say that you graduate from college and you get a C in a class and you find a paper that you find has been misgraded and would actually have given you a C+ in the class. You might not bother to go back and ask them to make the change because it's not going to be a huge pop on your GPA and you've already graduated. The question is moot. It no longer matters. Ripeness, however, has to do with whether or not a court will take a case because the issue needs to be decided or not. For example, right now in Chapter 3, we're going to talk about some anonymity cases. Anonymity cases online have jumped in the last couple years because cases are coming to the court and it is ripe for them to decide. Like a piece of fruit you don't want to eat when it's still green, you want to wait for something to ripen. If a case is not ripe, the case is unlikely to be taken by the court. Okay? Constitutionality and unconstitutionality are whether or not a law comports with the Constitution. If it does, it's constitutional and upheld. If it doesn't, it's overturned. Okay. Now, this little diagram here is the path of a civil case. Don't have to memorize it. You can just take a look at it. It basically starts with the complaint process, and then you're served. Okay, the defendant is served. They can answer. If they don't answer, there's a default, and it goes down to the judgment. If they do answer, discovery takes place. There's a pretrial conference and maybe a settlement. If there's no settlement, it goes to trial. Then there's a verdict or judgment, appeal, and it starts all over again. Criminal cases are not that much different. Okay, they're very similar. Okay? All right. Now, burden of proof. We've talked a little bit about the burden of proof. What is the burden of proof? The burden of proof is defined as who has to prove what and at what level of precision. Who has to prove what and at what level of precision, okay? So, if you've got a civil case, it's 50% or more, called the preponderance of the evidence, okay? If you are more likely than not sure that it happened X way, that's the opinion, okay? Because it's only about changing hands, okay? Now, if it's criminal and you're going to throw somebody in jail, it's got to be beyond a reasonable doubt. That's 90 to 95% sure, okay? There's also a standard called clear and convincing evidence that we will sometimes see in First Amendment cases. My 1A is my shorthand for First Amendment. And you very rarely get to beyond all doubt. Okay? So we will spend a lot of time in different cases talking about the burden of proof. Who has it and what do they have to prove? Okay. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about torts and damages. A tort, it's not a pie filled with apples, but it's a any civil wrong that creates the right for a victim to sue the perpetrator. If I smack you on the 405, if we bumper to bumper on 405 and I smack you in the back, that's tort. All right? If I slug you on the arm, that's battery. That's a tort. That creates a legal right for you to sue me. Okay? Overbeck has a nice example of a car accident and all the different torts that you can sue for. Okay? Damages are what you win. Okay? Usually we measure damages in money. There are a couple of different kinds of damages. There are general damages. That's like embarrassment. There's no specific dollar value. Usually that's what gets awarded by the jury. There are compensatory damages that compensate you for money that you've lost. All right? So if you're in a car accident, you could maybe sue for compensatory damages for lost wages or doctor bills or car repair, all that kind of a thing. And then there are punitive damages. Punitive comes from punish. All right? Sometimes juries will award very large damage amounts intended to punish the perpetrator. And it can be, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. Okay. All right. Now, I'm only going to talk quickly about where to find the law. There are several different places you can go. Okay? LexisNexis Universe is our school's version of being able to find the law for free. All right? You can look up law reviews. You can look up cases. You can look up statutes. All that stuff is all on LexisNexis.com/universe. You have to either be on a university computer or go through a proxy server. You can also get a lot of it for free on FindLaw.com. Every regulatory agency that's out there has a website, whether it's the FCC, the FTC, the FBI, the CIA, the Food and Drug Administration, etc. There's a couple of them right there. The ones that we'll talk about are the FCC and the FTC, so feel free to go check that out. Laws that are in process are usually covered on Thomas, which is the Library of Congress's legislative information site. You can find out where laws are in the legal process. You can also go to the Legal Information Institute, or LII, at Cornell, which does a very nice job categorizing and finding cases. And the official website of the federal courts is uscourts.gov. Every single state has its own court system. They all have their own setups, and most of them have their own websites as well. All right, just a couple more things. Now, reading a case citation, you never have to memorize a citation, but you should understand how one is created. The name of the case shows up in italics. Right, New York Times versus Sullivan. In this case, which again is talked about in depth in Chapter 1 in terms of the procedural stuff, and we'll talk about in Chapter 4 as well, is probably the most important case in media law. It's a libel case, and it really did set the stage for courts all over to expand First Amendment rights. In this case, New York Times had lost at the lower court level, and so when they appealed, they went first. So the case started out as Sullivan versus New York Times, and then it flip-flopped when Sullivan won and the New York Times appealed. Okay? So it's always, all right, basically plaintiff versus defendant in that order. Okay, so the person who's bringing the suit is the first position. The V is for versus. Now, this numbering system was created during a time, and they're still going to keep it at least at the Supreme Court level, was created during a time when there were physical books. Okay? So if you went to a law library and you went to the U.S. Reports, which is the major reporter for, the official reporter for Supreme Court cases, and you took down the physical book numbered 376, and you opened it up, and you flipped through the pages to page 254, that's the page number the case starts on. And then the year is the year that the case was decided. There are also lower courts, appeals courts, all that stuff. Again, you don't have to know that stuff. State abbreviations vary. Sometimes it's the states, like Massachusetts is MASS, period. All right, California has a different set of abbreviations. You'll often in my lecture notes see like 1CA or 9CA or 2CA. That's the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and those are lower court cases. If there is no other numbers or letters near the date, it's Supreme Court. Okay? I always, at the end of a chapter, put up the major points of the chapter so that you can take a look at them as sort of a review session. And if you've got questions, you know where to find me.